Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. Welcome back to Reclaiming the Republic. As you know, this is the only show that will give you the academic-based evidence as well as the academic-based solutions to what we have to do. It's irrefutable. As a matter of fact, you know, when I talk to people in the convention states, and, you know, a lot of times some of these folks are so highly vested. I mean, they pay money to become a director. They're contributing. They're paying money to be a part of this. It's the same thing with the John Birch Society. So here's two different organizations that, you know, are a group of people who I consider patriots, the members of these organizations. Now, leaders of these organizations I would not consider patriots because they're not putting the needs of the nation first. They're putting the needs of their organization first because clearly, if Meckler really cared about what was going on and what was the federal government was doing, or if Mark Levin or any conservative entertainer out there really cared, they would get behind Republic Review because it is the solution to getting the federal government back into compliance. You want to change the Constitution? After we get full compliance. Because they're running reckless while everybody's having discussions about changing the Constitution or on the John Birch Society about doing nothing. Well, that maintains our peril and our direction of falling off the precipice. We don't have a lot of time. And that's my biggest point. With those who are already motivated to taking action, those people in the Convention of States, this is why members of the Convention of States quickly get on board because they realize that this is action that can be done a lot faster. It doesn't mean that they leave the convention states. And it's the same thing with the John Birch Society. They don't have to leave their membership. Well, I mean, sometimes the leaders want to kind of castigate you and throw you out. I haven't seen that yet on the convention of states. I've got a lot of people that have either have left the convention of states or they still are involved with it, but they are directly supporting Republic Review because they see that it is the first real, or the reality is it is the first thing that can actually initiate and get the federal government on its heels and force it into compliance. So I need to try to quit being so passionate and yelling so much. So anyway, let me get back to the ratification debates, but I just have one more obligatory. The show is also sponsored by, actually two, the show is also sponsored by republicreview.org. And I wanted to point out, we do have a comment line, 425-270-5416. And it's nice because this is a 24-hour, you know, you can leave a message and we will get it. I've had many people call and leave that message and I get back with them. You will not find anybody slandering us that we don't get back to you because we even have the phone logs to prove that we call these folks back. So anyway, we're not going to give you their phone numbers, but what we will do is we will get back to you if you call. Thank you for listening, and let's let's quickly move on because we were talking, or actually Mr. Lee of Westmoreland was talking, and he was actually going into a new direction regarding enumerations. And so this is what we want to recover. We want to go into this because this is good stuff. This is, you know, this is just fruit off of the trees we've planted, or actually these great men. As a matter of fact, I like to liken the ratification debates as voices coming from the dust, telling us what we need to do, telling us what this Constitution really is. And so it's almost like the scriptures, you know, speaking from the dust and telling us, you know, the truths of the gospel of Christ. It's the same thing, the truths of Christ's Constitution. You know, that's why we were given this document with its amendments and everything else. Because, and I say this all the time, only the good Lord knew what we would need, what we would be facing in these days of absolute corruption and evil. Biden is, I want to see Biden and every single corrupt politician tried for their treasonous behavior. And if convicted, I want to see them punished. They deserve their due process just like any U.S. citizen. And as you know, these countries, because I was just talking about this in the last show, these countries that think we owe them debt, they want to get their pound of flesh, we will send them Biden, Pelosi, and everybody else. Say, have with what you will with these people who worked with you in trying to collude the collapse, because these nations know that they have no legal standing in taking on debt and spending money on things that we have never granted as a people to this government. So China knows. They're duplicit. Every single country that has been buying our debt is duplicit in defrauding the American people. What's it going to take to wake you up? This is the only, I hate to brag, and I'm not, but this really is the only radio station, only show that gives you this kind of truth. And if you want to prove me wrong, by all means. You know, you can't, though. Because when it comes down to this Constitution, this contract, it speaks for itself. The ratifications speak for itself. You have to prove them wrong. And you can't. So, this is what Mr. Lee of Westmoreland says. I say that this new system shows in stronger terms than words could declare that the liberties of the people are secure. Now, I know I've already read this, and so we'll get into, you know, what happens after this, but it goes on the principle that all powers is in the people and that the rulers have no powers but what are enumerated in that paper. They can't take on debt to spend on anything that is not listed in that paper, as I've been telling you. When a question arises with respect to legality of any power, exercised or assumed, Congress, exercised or assumed by Congress, it is plain on the side of the governed, of the people. Is it enumerated in the Constitution? When I say the governed, the people, I have to keep on clarifying when they say these things. This goes back to the state legislatures, our sovereigns, who are supposed to be watching these things. It's their job to be looking at this stuff. And so you really have to start understanding, you know, how important these documents are. And you have to start learning the importance of understanding this and getting your state legislatures to understand this as well. If it be legal and just, it is otherwise arbitrary and unconstitutional and illegal. Candor must confess that it is infinitely more attentive to the liberties of the people than any state government. That's a slap in the face to Henry and everybody else standing there. Mr. Lee then goes on and says that under the state governments, the people reserve to themselves certain enumerated rights, and that the rest were vested in their rulers. That's how it is in the states. In other words, we delegate all of these powers to the states, and we reserve to us very special rights. And as you've seen in Washington State, we reserve to us the right, right here in Washington State, the right to bear arms and constitutionally wear sidearms. And Governor Inslee has taken it upon himself to edict that we can't do this anymore. He is being arbitrary and tyrannical. People need to actually stand up and remove that man and have him tried. The problem is that the people have been lulled into believing that they can do whatever they want because that's government. We have lost our moral compass when it comes to civics and government because we have become illiterate regarding these things, these special things of liberty and justice, and government, and civics. Anyway, and the rest were vested in the rulers that consequently the powers reserved to the people were but an inconsiderable exception from what were given to the rulers, but that in the federal government, the rulers of the people were vested with certain defined powers. So The states have, you know, kind of general powers somewhat, but not so. We should, at the state level, and this is why you have to look at your state constitution. Are they enumerated or general or what? And you have to question every general power that has an association to a federal power, like the Department of Transportation, Environment, Housing, Education. Any general powers over issues that have created or tied to the federal government's demands, those are unconstitutional. And they should be stricken from your state constitutions, because the federal government cannot amend our state constitutions. Only in those laws pursuant to the Constitution. And none of these are in pursuant to the Constitution. That's my point. So anyway, as we move forward, and that what were not delegated to those rulers were retained by the people. The consequences of this, I'm going to reread this, he said, was that the limited powers were only an exception to those which rested with the people, and that they knew what they had given up and could be in no danger. He exemplified the proposition in a familiar manner. He observed that if a man delegated certain powers to an agent, like in a power of attorney, it would be an insult upon common sense to suppose that the agent could legally transact any business for his principal which was not contained in the commission whereby the powers were delegated. But that if a man empowered his representative or agent to transact all businesses except certain enumerated parts, the clear result was that the agent could lawfully transact every possible part of his principal's business except the enumerated parts, and that this plain proposition was sufficient to demonstrate the annuity and the folly of the Bill of Rights, or the concept of creating a Bill of Rights, because the way the Constitution was written. We'll be right back after these two promos. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL. Or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay. So what Mr. Lee of Westmoreland was just giving us is he was giving us a clarity regarding the need for an enumerated constitution in limiting and defining precisely what the federal government was to have. And the state governments had obviously more powers, because in the state governments, they basically created the Bill of Rights. Now, the Bill of Rights went by the wayside in all of these state governments, to be clear. Every single state government, after this Constitution was ratified, every state government reorganized itself into bicameral legislative bodies and echoed the tenor as well as the design of this U.S. Constitution. It was that brilliant. And so the necessity of having a Bill of Rights at the state level went away because, and this was the folly of those men in the states. And this was why down the road, the Bill of Rights really didn't become critical in the federal government. I say we strike the Bill of Rights out of the federal government, go back to the enumerated powers, and institute every state the Bill of Rights. Let the people recognize the difference where the rights need to be reserved by the people, and in the national or the general government, we only need to delegate enumerated powers instead of trying, because this is how we've gotten into problems regarding the Bill of Rights, because the federal government makes presumptions that the right of marriage is kind of a Bill of Rights, because even though it wasn't listed that they couldn't do it, it was something that they could protect. Are you kidding me? This is why the Bill of Rights really was more dangerous, and why these men that were arguing against the Bill of Rights at the federal level was more hazardous to the liberties of people. Anyway, so the next up, our next framer that is going to talk about the Constitution is an anti-federalist, but I want you to note what this anti-federalist is saying, because this is James Monroe. And so James Monroe, who's already got some problems with some direct taxes and some other things, listen to what he happens to say regarding this design of this government. I mean, he was very impressed. He says, "What is the object of the division of power in America? Why is the government divided into different branches? For a more faithful and regular administration? Where is the check? We have more to apprehend from the union of these branches than from the subversion of any. And this union will destroy the rights of the people." So he's seeing this, and he's echoing some of Henry's, you know, outlandish remarks. He's not pointing to how they're going to destroy it. Let's see if he does. But I don't think he does. He just makes general assertions. "There is nothing to prevent this coalition, but the contest which will probably subsist between the general government and the individual governments will tend to produce it. There is a division of sovereignty between the national and state governments." That's a clear fact. He's recognizing that there is a division of sovereignty, that the federal government has sovereignty over those enumerated powers, and that the states have sovereignty over everything else. "How far, then, will they coalesce together? Is it not supposed that there will be a conflict between them? If not, will not the members of the former combine together? Where then will be the check to prevent encroachments on the rights of the people? There is not a third essentially distinct branch to preserve a just equilibrium or to prevent such encroachments in developing this plan. We ought to attend the necessity of having checks. I see no real checks in it." He doesn't understand that the states are the checks, the vertical checks in the Constitution. And there are three branches. There's the judicial, the legislative, and the executive. Why does he say that there needs to be an essential third branch in just equilibrium? Anyway, he goes on and says, "Let us first inquire into the probability of harmony between the general and individual governments, and in the next place, into the responsibility of the general government, either to the people at large or to the state legislatures. As to the harmony between the governments, communion of power, legislative and judicial, forbids it." And so, understanding what he just basically said in the first paragraph and then this next paragraph, it might be that he was kind of speaking sarcastically or sardonic tone, and then he kind of goes into, well, let's investigate what kind of harmony we have. But I want you to understand that it probably was less sardonic and it was probably more sincerity, because he was an anti-federalist. But I believe he ended up voting for, we have to go all the way back to the checking of the yeas and nays, but I believe he ended up voting for the Constitution after the debates were fully wound down and after they went through everything. Well, The next up in the queue is Mr. John Marshall. And this is what Mr. John Marshall states. Mr. Chairman, I conceive that the object of the discussion now before us is whether democracy or despotism be most eligible. I am sure that those who framed the system submitted to our investigations and those who now support it intend the establishment and security of the former. The supporters of the Constitution claim the fide of being firm friends of liberty and the rights of mankind. They say they consider it as the best means of protecting liberty. We, sir, idolize democracy. Those who oppose it have bestowed eulogiums or monarchy. We prefer this system to any monarchy because we are convinced that it is a greater tendency to secure our liberty and promote our happiness. We admire it because we think it a well-regulated democracy. And see, when they're talking democracy, they're just talking about not a democratic form of government, but that the people do get to vote and select their representatives. And at the representative level, the representatives get to vote and, you know, representing their people as to which way to go. But not everything is on the table for representatives, only those things that are enumerated. Anyway, Marshall goes on and says, it is recommended to the good people of this country, they are through us to declare whether it be such a plan of government as will establish and secure their freedom. Permit me to attend to what the Honorable Gentleman, Mr. Henry, has said. He has expatiated on the necessity of a due attention to certain maxims, to certain fundamental principles from which a free people ought never to depart. I concur with him in the propriety of the observance of such maxims. They are necessary in any government, but more essential to a democracy than any other. What are the favorite maxims of democracy? A strict observance of justice, public faith, and a steady adherence to virtue. These, sir, are the principles of a good government. No mischief or misfortune ought to deter us from a strict observance of justice and public faith. Would to heaven that these principles have been observed under the present government. Had this been the case, the Friends of Liberty would not be so willing now to part with it. Can we boast that our government is founded on these maxims? Can we pretend to the enjoyment of political freedom or security when we are told that a man has been, by an act of assembly, struck out of existence without a trial by jury, without examination, without being confronted with his accusers and witnesses, without the benefits of the law of the land? Where is our safety when we are told that this act was justifiable because the person was not a Socrates? What has become of the worthy member's maxims? Is this one of them? Shall it be a maxim that a man shall be deprived of his life without the benefit of law? Shall such a deprivation of life be justified by answering that man's life was not taken sanctum artem because he was a bad man? Shall it be a maxim that government ought not to be powered to protect virtue? And so this retort is just like Hamilton's retort. And as a matter of fact, as I pointed out before, Marshall was a protege, Hamilton was Marshall's mentor, and Marshall was the protege of Hamilton. Like, that's the right relationship. Yeah, I got that right. So anyway, this is like one of the first times that Marshall even pipes up into this debate, and it's not like he's really being very definitive. Later on, he does get definitive, and we'll point that out. But when he steps up, you can kind of tell that he's just throwing out either, we'll call it theory, because look at it, I mean, he even relates to Socrates. We will point out later on that we will find that Marshall even though he was here and he understood the ratification debates, he was the first to obfuscate them. He was the first to try to put them into the closet. And if he could have, I believe Marshall and Hamilton would have burned the ratification debates. And if you, I believe that some of the copies of the ratification debates at the federal level were actually burned. And, you know, when they, when D.C. was burned by Britain in 1812, then that's what we would find, is that those copies that were in the library of Washington, D.C., or the Library of Congress at the time, you'll find that those ratification debates, their copies that they had, were just that. They were gone. They were destroyed by Britain and the troops that descended upon D.C. But the fact of the matter is, every state still had their own copies. And I believe that Marshall and Hamilton would have preferred to see the originals, the original copies, and all of the copies of the ratification debates destroyed, because their intention was to try to generalize and basically imply powers that were not within the Constitution, as Hamilton did. Anyway, we will be back after these next two promos.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, health care, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. Okay, so next up, we have Mr. Nicholas, who's going to kind of talk about a few different things. The first thing he brings up is common law, and I'm just going to read a very short, concise sentence. He will be absolutely disqualified to hold any place of profit he's talking about, any member of Congress, and any public servant. He would absolutely be disqualified to hold any place of profit, honor, or trust, and liable to further punishment if he has committed such crimes as are punishable at common law. So the point of this one little sentence is the fact that common law is the law of the land. Every single state in the Union at this point in time had recognized and established common law as the law of the state. The law of the state was dictated by the states, not by the federal government, which is why the federal government never dictated to the states what law they were to use. This actually opened the door for Louisiana to maintain civil law. If you don't understand common law and civil law, I'm not going to go down because it's a long discussion, but we will get into it later, and we'll probably have Brent Winters back on to talk about civil law and, and common law. When I get into the details with experts like Brent Winters, it can really take a long time to identify what the difference between civil law is. And sometimes, metaphorically speaking, he'll say civil law is the law of the city. Common law is the law of the land. And he tries to simplify it by doing that, but it doesn't necessarily, I think for most people, it's hard for them to create the correct associations. So anyway, the next thing that Mr. Nicholas, that we want to bring out of this next dissertation, this is actually in the same dissertation. I'm just bringing out highlights. Remember, these are only highlights regarding direct tax. And he says this, another argument made use is that ours is the largest state and must pay in proportion to other states. How does that appear? The proportion of taxes are fixed by the number of inhabitants and not regulated by the extent of the territory or fertility of the soil. If we be wealthier in proportion than any other states, it will fall lighter upon us than poorer states. They must fix the taxes so that the poorer states can pay and Virginia be richer, will it be easier? The honorable gentleman says that the first collections are to go to Congress and that the state legislatures must bear all deficiencies. How does this appear? Does he prove it? Nothing of it appears in the plan itself. The Congress and the state legislatures have concurrent jurisdictions in the laying of taxes. There is no rule that shows Congress shall have the first collections. Each is independent of the other. Another argument against this disingenuous construction is drawn from that clause which regulates representation, which is conclusive from the words themselves. Quote, representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to the respective numbers. Each state will know from its population its proportion of any general tax, as it was justly observed by the gentleman over the way, Mr. Randolph, and who was a Federalist and was a delegate at and supported the Constitution, but it was a delegate at the convention. Anyway, Nicholas goes on and says, they cannot possibly exceed that proportion. They are limited and restrained expressly to it. The state legislatures have no check of this kind. Their power is uncontrolled. This excludes the danger of interference. Each collects its own taxes and bears its own deficiencies, and officers are accountable to each government for the different collections. He goes on later and talks a little bit more about taxes. He says, quote, the taxes for paying that proportion shall be laid and levied by the authority and direction of the legislatures of the several states within the time agreed upon by the United States in Congress assembled. Now, sir, by a comparison of this article and the clause in the Constitution, we shall find them to be nearly the same. The common defense and general welfare are the objects expressly mentioned to be provided for in both systems. The power in the Confederation to secure and provide for those objects was constitutionally unlimited. The requisitions of Congress are binding to the states, though from the imbecility of their nature, they cannot be enforced. He's talking about the Articles of Confederation. The same power is intended by the Constitution. The only difference between them is that Congress is, by this plan, to impose the taxes on the people, whereas by the Confederation, they are laid upon the states. The amount to be raised and the power given to raise it is in the same principle. The mode of raising is only different, and this difference is founded on the necessity of giving the government that energy. Without it, it cannot exist. Now, he says the direct tax on the people, he's not taking this literally where the IRS goes to the people. It's on the people by apportionment. In other words, the states have to pay based on how many people, based on the census that the state has. So from 1790 to the year 1800, let's just say one of the states actually grew gangbusters. Well, they would have the benefit because they would have this huge influx of people, and their taxes would only be based on that census capture. Do you follow me on this? So by the end of the decade before the next census, they're actually getting productivity and an economic boom by all these people coming in and working and doing things over the next 10 years that the federal government isn't even actualizing, because they are tied to the 10-year census and the apportionment based every 10 years. You see? So anyway, the power has not been reprobated in the Confederation. It not be blamed in the proposed plan of government. So now he talks about necessary and the what they call the sweeping clause, or the necessary and proper clause. The gentleman has adverted to what he calls the sweeping clause and etc., and represents it as a replete with great dangers. Now, this is why the Virginia ratification debates are so good, because they actually identify these mystical clauses, the necessary and proper, the common defense and general welfare, the supremacy clause, and the commerce clause. So anyway, this dreaded clause runs in the following words, quote, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all the powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States, or in any department or officer thereof, close quote. The committee will perceive that the Constitution has enumerated all the powers which the government, the general government, should have, but it did not say how they were to exercised. It therefore, in this clause, tells that they shall be exercised. Does this give away any new power? I say not. Suppose it had been inserted at the end of every power that they should have power to make laws to carry out that power in execution. Would this have increased their powers? If therefore it could not have increased their powers if placed at the end of each power, it cannot increase their powers at the end of all. This clause only enables them to carry into execution the powers given to them, but it gives them no additional powers. But it is objected to for a want of Bill of Rights. Now he's talking about how, they're shooting all over the place, and this goes to show how apt the anti-federalists in Virginia were in active, and how hard, if you want to really understand the difficulty in ratifying in Virginia compared to every other state, there was a formidable anti-federalist force here. And Henry was a very smart and very powerful orator in articulating his arguments. Anyway, so now he focuses on their argument for a Bill of Rights. But it is objected for a want of a Bill of Rights. It is a principle universally agreed upon that all powers not given are retained, whereby the Constitution, the general government, has general powers for any purpose. It is not its powers are the general government has general powers for any purpose. Its powers are absolute. Where it has powers with some exceptions, they are absolute only as to those exceptions. In other cases, the people retain what is not conferred on the general government, as it is by their positive grant that it has of any powers. In England, in all disputes, now this is the part you really want to pay attention to, because I think he really nails it in this short portion of the paragraph. In England, in all disputes between the king and the people, recurrence is had to the enumerated rights of the people to determine, are the rights in dispute secured? Are they included in the Magna Carta or the Bill of Rights, etc.? Because the king had general powers. So in other words, the king had these general powers, but England had the Bill of Rights and the Magna Carta. So did these rights get secured in the Bill of Rights or the Magna Carta? If they had, then the king could not do anything. And what he actually says here is, if not, they are generally speaking within the king's prerogative. In disputes between Congress and the people, the reverse of the proposition holds. Is the disputed right enumerated? If not, Congress cannot meddle with it. that right there tells you everything. If it is not enumerated, they cannot meddle. They can't borrow money to do social engineering. It's that simple. So, as we move forward to prove that we have a house of cards in Mordor on the Potomac, then you can start understanding what we need to do. And Republic Review is the only solution. We'll be back after these two promos. Thank you so much. If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so you can see why some of these comments coming out of the ratification debates in Virginia are just gold. In disputes between Congress and the people, the reverse of the proposition holds. Is the disputed right enumerated? In other words, can the government actually have that power? Is it enumerated? Can they exercise that power? If not, Congress cannot meddle with it. That's why religion. Can they make any law regarding religion at all? It is not enumerated? No. We didn't need a Bill of Rights to say that. Now, some things that were not included, like the right of petitioning for the redress of grievances, that is something that we should have had, not just because, you know, it was a right, but it needed to be in there so that people knew, because over time, those things just evaporate. People don't even understand that that's actually a right. So anyway, as we move on, we're actually going to be picking up Mr. Madison's comments. So Mr. Nicholas ends the day. I mean, he was, boom, knocking him out of the park. He went a long dissertation. And on June 11th, the next day, up at the beginning of the day, the first person to speak is Mr. Madison. And this is what he says. I shall take a view of certain subjects, which will lead to some reflections to quiet the minds of those gentlemen who think that the individual governments will be swallowed up by the general government. In order to effect this, it is proper to compare the state governments with the general government, with respect to the reciprocal dependence and with the respect to the means they have of supporting themselves or of encroaching on one another. At the first comparison, we must be struck with these remarkable facts. The general government has not the appointment of a single branch of the individual governments or of any other officers within the states to execute their laws. Are not the states integral parts in the general government? It is not the president chosen under the influence of the state legislatures. We may not suppose that he will be complacent to those whom he has been appointed and from whom he must have his reappointment. The senators are appointed altogether by the legislatures. I want to point out here that what he's talking about is this concept that comes out later, that who is it that's supposed to execute the laws of Congress? Who are the enforcers? Is it the IRS? Is it the ATF? Is it the BLM? No. The enforcers of all constitutional law is the militia. This is the brilliance of this system. And we'll get into why, because they're going to talk about standing armies. And you could actually read my articles that actually incorporate these citations from the ratification debates. But I am telling you that when we go through these things, things become really, really clear that these men understood in this Constitution exactly why they had to do things the way they did to keep the federal government in check. My honorable friend apprehended a coalition between the President, Senate, and the House of Representatives against the states. This could be supposed, and I would presume that the friend he may have been talking about may have been Monroe. This could be supposed only from a similarity of the component parts. A coalition is not likely to take place because its component parts are heterogeneous in their nature. The House of Representatives is not chosen by the state governments, but under the influence of those who compose the state legislatures. Let us suppose 10 men appointed to carry the government into effect. There is an every degree of certainty that they would be indebted for their re-election to the members of the legislatures. If they derive their appointment from them, will they not execute their duty to them? Besides this, will not the people, whose predominant interest will ultimately prevail, feel great attachment to the state legislatures? They have the care of all local interests. Those familiar domestic objects for which men have the strongest predilection, the general government, on the contrary, has the preservation of the aggregate interest of the Union. Objects which, being less familiar and more remote from men's notice, have a less powerful influence in their minds. Do we not see a great and natural attachments arising from local considerations? This will be the case in much stronger degree in the state governments than in the general government. The people will be attached to their state legislatures from a thousand causes, and into whatever scale the people at large will throw themselves, that scale will perpetuate. Now, I want to point out that in the beginning, access to government for the people was really apprehended that it was their state, because the federal government was so far away and the federal government's powers had no effect of their everyday life. It wasn't until they started violating the Constitution where the federal government started getting into their knickers of building roadways everywhere, supporting and subsidizing the railroads, supporting and subsidizing farmers. All of these things were unconstitutional usurpations. Then when they started actually organizing the government with executive departments for the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Interior, the Department of Justice, the Department of Labor, so forth and so on, housing, energy, all of these things which are not enumerated in the Constitution, well, it got so far out of hand that they are doing things and they're creating regulations that they have no power to do regarding energy and the money that they're spending. Keep in mind that these executive departments, the budget for the Department of Energy is unconstitutional, which means that the debt that they take to operate that portion of government is unconstitutional. It's debt we're not, that's what I'm trying to emphasize this for you so that you understand.
You want to get rid of that debt? You want to get rid of the threat of China? Republic review is the only process to do this, that the states assert their authority over this child government that they created. The parents are the states. The child is the federal government. Do you get it now? Are you starting to see the light and how clear this is? Anyway, I'm sorry for getting a little passionate, but I'm not really sorry. Now there's this guy by the name of Mr. Grayson. And Mr. Grayson happens to be the one person kind of like, what was the guy's name? Doggone it, Bloodworth or whatever in North Carolina kind of made fun of him. Well, Mr. Grayson is not, I don't want to be disparaging, but, you know, he just doesn't get it. I mean, they go on and on regarding, you know, certain things. And he goes, well, okay, you've explained this to me how many times, Bloodworth or whatever. Anyway, Mr. Grayson is that anti-federalist that just doesn't get it. And so anyway, he says this, as to direct taxation, giving up this and you give up everything, as to the highest act of your sovereignty, surrender up this inestimable jewel and you throw away a pearl richer than all of your tribe. But it has been said by the honorable gentleman, Mr. Pendleton, as well as I recollect, that there could be no such thing as an interference between the two legislatures, either in point of direct taxation or in any other case whatsoever. An honorable gentleman, Mr. Mason, who's an anti-federalist, has replied that they might interfere in the case of poll tax. I will go further and say that the case may happen in the judiciary. Suppose a state execution at a federal execution issued against the same man, and that the state officer and federal officer seize him at the same moment. Would they have to divide the man in two, as Solomon directed the child to be divided, who was claimed by two women? I suppose the general government is being paramount would prevail. And this is the most important part, because I want you to understand the language of the time. This is the only reason I'm really reading some Grayson stuff, is because he actually provides the paradigm of these people, of the framers at this time. This is what he says. How are two legislatures to coincide with powers transcendent, supreme, and omnipotent? For such is the definition of a legislature. What did he just say? What is a legislature? Supreme, omnipotent, transcendent with powers. Sovereigns. They understood that when you delegated power of government to the legislatures, the legislative power itself. So in England, legislative power was given to the king, and then they created the parliament, and then the legislative powers would go back and forth. And certain legislative powers would stay with the king and then with parliament. So, but in America, legislative power was the sovereignty of government. And so where did they reside? And he was pointing to the fact that in Congress alone, they had two sovereign legislative powers. And coinciding with the Congress legislative powers, you have state legislative powers. And this was what his point was. How can you have two legislatures to coincide with powers transcendent, supreme, and omnipotent? Well, apparently, Mr. Grayson couldn't get it, that the only thing that the federal government was supreme, as far as the laws of the federal government, they were only supreme when they were in pursuant to, in other words, directly tied and related to the Constitution. They had to be within the enumerated powers. Any power that they're usurping is not an absolute power. It is a usurpation and fraud and or a violation of the Constitution. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobius Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobius Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.